I'm an addict. My name is Joseph. My recovery date is October 2nd, 2005, and for that I'm extremely grateful. I got clean sober in El Paso, Texas, right on the border, yeah, where I was born and raised. So I am the youngest child in a nuclear family. My dad's was in the military. My mom was a teacher. She's about yay high. Now that she's getting older, she's yay high. And for all intents and purposes, I had a normal childhood. Parents were involved. You could say that mom was really involved. When I was in second grade, she was my second grade substitute teacher. And I could tell you that in recovery, what I've realized in going through the steps and in my growing process, I've been able to see all these little, you know, times in my life and in my childhood where my disease started to manifest, right? And so what my parents told me and how I interpreted and internalized what they told me carried on through my adulthood. So in second grade, when mom was my substitute teacher, I pull her aside and I say, "Mom, can I?" And she's like, "In here, I'm Miss Sanchez, not mom." And I remember getting in trouble in that class. And at, during that time, if you went to detention, detention had the you know, kind of walled off desks, right? So you were in cubicle style desks. But at that age and at that time, we didn't go to detention. So mom thought it was a good idea to create a little cubicle out of cardboard and put it around my desk so that I couldn't talk to people and get myself in trouble. Well, like any good little addict, I still found ways to get in trouble. I remember another one of her attempts was to pull my desk right aside hers so that she can keep an eye on me. And so she became not only the substitute teacher in my second grade, but became the assistant librarian in my middle school and the librarian in my high school. So she kind of followed me throughout my education, and I still managed to sneak off and get drunk and high, you know. And I could tell you that it wasn't, there wasn't any kind of neglect or any kind of abuse in the family, but for some reason, I always felt like I was being treated unfair and that that I was different from and separated from. And I started to realize that substances, anything, would take me out of myself. So I have a cousin that is 1 week older than I am and a quarter of an inch shorter than I am. And I have to say that because I'm proud of that quarter of an inch, right? If you're 5, you want to, you know, maintain that height. Anyway, so he was my my cousin was my drinking buddy, my party buddy, and we started to drink probably 11, 12 years old, because our older uncles and cousins and at family events would, you know, they'd be, you know, drinking, and, you know, it was in a Hispanic machismo culture, that was a thing to do, it was a rite of passage. And so I remember us, you know, being told or asked to, you know, bring my uncles and our family a beer, and we'd bring a beer and squirrel one off for ourselves and sneak sips. So we progressed from sharing a can of beer to having our own beer, and then to taking little shots and then just to take chugs out of the bottle. And so my cousin was my best friend. And when we got to an age where I could stay over at his place, where his parents really didn't care what we did, I did that every weekend. And we proceeded to get drunk every weekend. And I remember one of our go-to excuses was bad cheese, right? Because we'd get sick in the morning. So we'd get sick in the morning. Oh, we're hungover. Sick in the morning. Oh, it must have been the bad cheese. Yeah. So at that time, at about middle school, going into middle school, so elementary into middle school, I was picked on by a lot of folks, right? So I didn't like sports. I had allergies. I still have allergies that, you know, I can't do anything outside. People started calling me names and picking on me. And that further brought home that feeling of not feeling a part of, right? So what I did is, you know, once the weekend came around, I drank that away, you know, numb myself. And I would say in high school, things started to get considerably more different. It wasn't just, you know, just booze on the weekends. It was actually drinking and using throughout the week. And I managed to get away with that while my mom was a librarian. So it was kind of, that took talent, I thought. I popped my collar on that. And I was like, yeah. And I remember getting caught. My parents pulled me aside, and I had some rolling papers that they found in my stuff. And I'm like, oh, it's my friends. And they completely bought that. And I realized that, you know, I could get away with anything, you know, at least in their eyes. So riding on this feeling of not being a part of or feeling different than, I proceeded to do, you know, anything that I could in order to kind of, you know, push that envelope of getting away with stuff. I would steal from stores, a lot of stores, clothing stores, convenience stores, anything that, you know, could give me that rush. It wasn't that I couldn't, you know, ask for money to pay for it, but it's just that I wanted to get away with something, to, you know, feel that rush. And I realized that, you know, if it wasn't one thing, it was another, that, you know, I was seeking something outside of myself to get away from not feeling a part of or less than or all those names that, you know, they called me on the playground. And so fast forward to, I would say, my freshman year in college. I managed to get into college, and I went to New Mexico State, which is 30 minutes away from El Paso, because I needed to be away from El Paso, but not too far away, right? I still need to get my laundry done. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so I remember, because I'm a band geek, right? I played on the drum line throughout my high school and into college career. And, all those stories, like one time at band camp, yeah, it's true. So I remember in my freshman year in college, I started to feel like I fit in because of the tolerance that I built up to substances. So I could drink like a fish, you know, and hang with the big guys and got my name, nicknamed after a bottle of Caribbean rum. Yeah. And I remember I went to we went on a band trip. Oh, God, that sounds like such a geeky thing to say. We went on a band trip. So we went on a band trip. We went to Europe, and there was some alumni from that college that went, and so it was supposed to be this magical trip, and we got blitzed the whole time we were there. I don't even remember if we performed like we were supposed to perform. I just knew that we were getting really, really messed up. And there was an alumni there that somebody told, or there was whispers of, that he was gay, and I was like, yeah, whatever. And we got drunk in Paris, and we had tons and tons and tons and tons of cheap beer. And I remember that night making a move on him and then completely regretting everything. And so the next day he had written me a long letter pretty much saying that there was this whole coming out process and that it's difficult and that he would always be there for me as a friend, as a shoulder to cry on, but not at the capacity that I wanted him to be there. And so I started that coming out process. So I was 18 years old, and I drink a case of beer every night, crying myself to sleep, because I was raised that if you were gay, that you were going to hell, and that you were a mistake, and I didn't want it. And, you know, God bless my roommate at the time, you know, he had to put up with me, and he was about the second person I came out to, and is still one of my closest friends today, and, he gave me a hug and said, it's going to be okay, but maybe you should start looking at your drinking. So chasing any kind of impossibility of having a relationship with somebody that was already in a relationship, I realized that if I changed my major from band to hotel and tourism management, that I could possibly get an internship at a hotel either in Aspen, Colorado, or in Dallas, Texas. And it so happened that, you know, he had moved to Dallas to do some work, and so I followed, right? Because that made sense. I left everything, moved to Dallas, and worked at a hotel, and tried a poor attempt to make any kind of relationship with him who was already involved with. But he was only the first person, the first man that actually paid attention to me that actually was kind, right? That didn't treat me like shit, or didn't treat me like I felt I needed to be treated. And so there was one night I had a friend, and I was about 19 at the time, and we snuck into some bar, and the bartender paid me attention, and a week later, I moved out of my apartment and moved into his. Yeah. He, as a bartender, he would get tipped with little baggies. And I was like, oh, we're going to have fun, right? I know these baggies. And so, yeah, there was a lot of baggies. There was a lot of baggies, there was a lot of booze, and he was undiagnosed with bipolar disorder, and so he had tons of mood swings, and then booze on top of that, that really didn't help out. And so I did tons of booze and tons of baggies. So the baggies changed, and I was introduced to meth, and that was pretty horrible. So it turns out that I love meth and sex, right? And they go hand in hand for me. And even though I'm in a relationship, that doesn't really matter. So I you know, I'm with that guy for 5 years, and I cheat on him for 5 years, and we get into arguments, and there's one day that, you know, it was one of those just, like, early morning kind of binge things, and we got into an argument, and I remember him being a little bit taller than me, and me pushing him into a window, and the window breaks, and I remember grabbing a piece of glass and standing over him and getting ready to stab him with that glass. And he dared me because he didn't think I would do it. And I did. I did it. And by the grace of God, it didn't do any damage. Aside from, well, physical damage to him, but the damage that it did to me, I couldn't believe that I had gotten to that point. That, you know, my mother's son got to a place where, you know, I'm physically hurting someone. And so that was shortly after, that was my first suicide attempt. I was really, really messed up, and I couldn't remember if it was warm water that made you bleed out or it was cold water. And so I sat in about 2 inches of lukewarm water. And things were going pretty slow, so I knock on the door, and you know, I ask for help, and I get bandaged up, and 2 weeks after that, I move out, right? Really messy, right? And I move out into my own, that was my own first apartment, my first big boy apartment, all by myself. And it happened to be located right next door to my dealer. So that didn't go well. I got a month off in my rent because the manager, you know, I got high and slept with him and said, "Hey, can I get a month off?" He said, "Yes," and lost his job a month later, and there was nothing written down. So within 7 months, I had 3 eviction notices on the door. The front door was deadbolted and had the little chain lock on it, and we entered and exited the apartment. And I said we because a friend that I was working with, he partied, so I said, "Hey, sleep on the couch, or don't sleep on the couch," right? Because who sleeps, right? So we exited and entered the apartment through a sliding door that everybody in the apartment complex knew was unlocked. So I'd come home after working, and I'm like, I'm missing some DVDs. And then I go over to, you know, my drug dealer's apartment, and I'm like, I used to have that. That ended pretty badly. I remember walking to the bar and getting really blitzed and seeing somebody, you know, a van parked in an alley, and, you know, that lighter going and that pipe in the air, and I was like, "I wonder what you're doing." And hopping into some stranger's vehicle and going somewhere so we can get high. And I end up getting mugged. And a good majority of my stories that are really, really messy, I end up butt naked. I don't know why, but I do. So this guy asked for my clothes, and I'm like, "All right." And then he says, "I got a knife, now get out." And I'm like, "Oh, man." So when it gets to a place where I can, you know, kind of grab what I can and roll out of the van, I do. And I end up, you know, running around in the neighborhood, like, with my clothes balled up in my arms and one shoe, and hiding in a shrub and trying to make the phone call 911. and saying a silent prayer, one of those foxhole prayers. God, if you get me through this, what? I'll never do it again, right? So that guy finds me, takes the rest of my clothes, my phone, and leaves me with that one shoe. And I go and I go and I knock on someone's door, and a friend of mine who was always there came and picked me up and, you know, gave me food and let me sleep it off. And so, yeah, that was one of the first times that I ended up messed up and naked walking around the street. The second time it was the weekend of my birthday. I'm a July baby. Yeah, that's right. So my birthday is July 14th, Bastille Day. That's French Independence Day, if you didn't know. So July 14th was my birthday, and that month, I guess I had slept in a couple of strange places, but I had a little bit of itchies going on down south, and so someone suggested I go to a clinic, and I go to a clinic, and they say, "Hey, have you been picking at your arms?" I'm like, "No. Why don't we, while we have you here, why don't we do some blood work on you?" I'm like, "Okay, sure, whatever. What's it going to cost?" "It's free. It's a free clinic." I'm like, "Sure, because I like free shit." So I got, you know, the doctor's recommendations for the itchies down south, and I was supposed to come back 2 weeks later to get the results of my blood work. And so I did, and the doctor said, "Good news, bad news." Good news, you know, the itchies are gone. Bad news, you're HIV positive. And I couldn't believe that he delivered the information that way. And I said, "Well, it's not like it was, you know, back in the day. You know, it's similar to diabetes." And I said, "Dude, I'm Mexican. Diabetes runs in my family. HIV doesn't." And he says, "Good point." So, yeah. So the doctor, the doctor gives me space, and I'm pacing the clinic, and freaking out, and that doctor let me leave the facility all by myself, and that was one of the biggest mistakes. That's the only thing that I remember from that day. But I've been told, right? I've been told that. At that time, I was working with Corporate Coffee, and one of my regulars was from El Paso, and she was a cop. And I was told that I had gotten extremely wasted and ended up walking home from, you know, wherever, but naked to my apartment and getting pulled over by a cop. I guess you get pulled over when you're walking? Pull over! This cop... shines their light, and it turns out to be that it's that same cop that's a friend of mine. And so, you know, that's another incident where even in the mess, retrospectively, you know, looking back at it, I was able to see God's presence in my life, right? Because I know at that point I should have been really... in trouble. And so she took me to my apartment, and the next day I called her still messed up, telling her that she owed me X amount of money for the drugs that she took away from me, and yeah, how obnoxious. Yeah. She's on my men's list. So it doesn't get a lot better after that. I continued to, you know, use heavily, use hard. I had a lot of guilt and shame. And I remember that I had gone on a little bit of a bender and thinking that I was on a reality TV show. because why not, right? So I'm driving up one-way streets, and I'm, you know, talking to parked cars and, you know, that whole gambit. And I call a couple of friends, and, you know, they laugh, and they say, ha ha, you need to go to bed. And I'm like, you're in on it. You're laughing, right? And I call that one friend that I usually call that's always there, and he says, Joe, are you okay? And I hang up on him. And that was the second time that I committed suicide or attempted to end my life. I took somebody else's medication, a whole lot of it, turned on some music really loud. At that time, I had a dog that I was not taking care of. The dog was barking. This time, I got the water right, but there was water all over the floor. And the EMS show up, and evidently they remember me because they've been to my apartment at another time that I don't remember. And the doctor told my friend that if he had waited 5 minutes, I would have died. And I'd like to say that that was the last time that I used. So in a matter of 48 hours, my parents drove from El Paso to Dallas, packed me up, and drove me back home. And I was pretty depressed for about a month, and my dad was over it. I was staying with my parents, and my dad said, okay, we're going to get you through this. We're going to get you a job. You're going to come work with me. So I managed a liquor store. I managed to rob that liquor store blind. So it turns out that one of my coworkers at the liquor store, she had the connect, the hookup, and I was like, we're going to be best friends, and we were, until she got in trouble, and I didn't. And so we got to a place where, again, I was seeing things, and I got in trouble, and my parents were out of town, and I was house-sitting for them. And they had a hot tub and, you know, a big TV, and I had drugs and booze. And so I turned their place into, you know, this tawdry den of, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So I remember leaving two complete strangers in my parents' place with tons of coke on counters and, you know, porn and whatever going on. And they came home. I was at somebody else's house sleeping it off. My dad picked me up, and I came to their house, and my mom was on her hands and knees cleaning up after me, and sleeping for a couple of days after that. And I figured that if I went to rehab, that they'd get off my back and they'd give me a pass, right? And so that weekend, we didn't see a lot of me, and then on that Monday, I went into rehab, and it was supposed to be 5-7 days, right? Did you ever get that? Oh, it's going to be 5-7 days. Mm-hmm. Well, on day 6, they brought more luggage. And I said, what is going on? So I had slept that whole weekend, so I really didn't need a lot of detox. So, you know, they gave me the regular meds, but they pulled me off of that relatively early. And I remember at that detox facility, they brought 12-step meetings, and that's where I heard my story. There was a 60-year-old woman, short, just like my mom. She smelled like patchouli. And she wore tie-dye, and I was like, what is she going to say to me? And she told me, she shared her story of feeling less than and separate from and not a part of. And I was like, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. And then we read something. It was Narcotics Anonymous that brought that meeting out, and we read the pamphlet, We Do Recover. And I remember, you know, I remember feeling like there was a little bit of hope. So I did 30 days in a residential recovery program. It was run by, you know, people in recovery, four people in recovery. And we went to meetings every day, sometimes two times or four times on the weekends. It was a lot of meetings. No, but I'm grateful for that because what they did is they introduced me to the recovery community. And whenever I left, I know exactly where to go. And who to talk to, and I wasn't afraid to call anybody because I've already sat next to them in meetings. And so I was introduced to the man that would be my sponsor at a recovery dance. If you've ever been to a recovery dance, oh geez, yeah. So the facility brought us, and we're all lined up against the wall. Right, it was a Halloween dance. We're all lined up against the wall. The jams are going. There's like three people on the dance floor. I'm like, oh my God, if recovery's going to be like this. So at that time, I mentioned it was a recovery Halloween dance. So the guy that I was introduced and that would be my first sponsor, he was in, you know, makeup and a costume. And I remember the next meeting that I went to, he's like, hey, do you remember me? I'm like, no, who are you? And it was the beginning of an awesome relationship. It was the first man that I trusted with everything, all the skeletons in my closet, and that didn't kind of cringe, right? When, you know, in judgment. You're like, oh, yeah. And I remember him telling me a story of himself when, you know, running around his apartment with a knife with his, you know, his spouse. So I was like, oh, yes, now you get it, you know. And so I can tell you in the first year of my recovery, I worked a step every month. And so I got clean in October, and by the third step, it was December, right? And I met who would be my best friend in detox, and we were in that residential recovery center together, and we were completely polar opposites, right? He was older and from out of town and had these awesome stories. His name was Bruno, and he would tell the best stories, right, and make recovery so attractive. And so I had a vehicle, but I didn't have enough money to put gas in it. He said, come pick me up. Let's go to a meeting. God will take care of it. I'm like, oh, whatever. But I did it, right? So I pick him up. We go to a meeting. And for some reason, we ended up with, well, I know what the reason was, because we had a good hustle, right? Who else can wake up broke in the morning, you know, get high and drunk all day, and end the day with $5 in their pocket? I mean, we were resourceful people, I have to say that. So, you know, in that carried over into recovery, we would go to a couple of meetings and then have enough for some, you know, Wendy's chili. I'm like, all right. So Bruno and I decided that we were going to do this, you know, awesome recovery theme. We're going to be circuit speakers, and we're going to travel all over, and la, la, la. And it was great. I mean, we would do this thing for, like, the daily meditation. We'd pick a day, just any day, and it was exactly what we needed to hear. And so we'd have, you know, hour-long, you know, conversations about recovery, the universe, God, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, and we'd have two-hour-long conversations around your mama jokes and just, you know. And so it was the first belly laugh. You know, that laugh that you have that, you're like, oh, please, I'm going to pee, stop, right? And I remember having those laughs in recovery. And you know, thinking to myself, okay, you know, this isn't too bad. This you know, this isn't going to be that bad. And so Bruno had diabetes, and he was getting his medication from a clinic that, you know, work primarily with people experiencing homelessness. And so I was at a place where I was uncomfortable with that. And he ran out of his insulin, and we were waiting. Bless you. That was a good sneeze. So we were waiting at the clinic, and he saw that I was getting uncomfortable, and he said, "Well, let's go ahead and leave. I'll get it tomorrow." And for him, there wasn't a tomorrow. He got really sick. He went into a diabetic coma and died on Christmas Eve. And I carried that stuff with me in recovery. And so that was the first death in recovery, right? So in that first year, you have a whole bunch of firsts. You know, first birthday, first, you know, celebrations, and first deaths. And I remember being in step three, and I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to have this relationship with a power greater than myself. I'm supposed to turn things over, and yet you take away, you know, the people that are going to support me in this new journey. And I was so pissed off at God, right? And I remember going to a meeting the day that Bruno passed away, and we circled up like we usually do at the end of a meeting, and this tall guy, he pulls me in, crushes me a little, and he says, "You know what? This is one of those no matter what moments." And I internalized that. I internalized that, you know, no matter what happens, if I don't use, I can get through it. And so I did. He had an awesome service, and I'd like to say that he's, you know, traveled with me in my experiences in recovery. So in step three, I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to need this like huge magical experience in order to turn something over. And I remember sitting in bed crying because at that time, Bruno had passed away. And then, you know, a few different people had gone missing. And I remember feeling so heavy on the heart. Because I was, you know, it was like I was carrying them with me, right? You build up these relationships in recovery, and you want everybody to get this awesome life. And then people start falling off by the wayside, and it just feels so heavy. And I remember sitting in my bed crying, and just having this split second of silence where it was like I was forcing myself kind of to cry because I wanted to cry, but then nothing was there. And I realized that I was done. You know, I was done crying and done having to be in control and in charge and having to take care of. And that's when I realized that that third step, if I turn things over, right, life doesn't become unmanageable. Life doesn't become unbearable. And that through, you know, through that relationship, I can get through anything, right? And so fast forward to moving here to Austin. I had the opportunity, I have a few minutes, I had an opportunity to move here to Austin to do some of the same work that I was doing in El Paso around recovery support services and teaching recovery coaches. And so I took it. Honestly, it's green, right? In El Paso, if you've ever been El Paso during a dust storm, you can't smile, and then you have like a load of crap, like just a sand in your ears. It's just horrible. So anyways, I end up here, and I get into the business here, and I think if you are working in the recovery industry here in Austin, you have to at least work for Austin Recovery once. So I have. I think it's a rule, right? That's a rule. And I realized that that a lot of the recovery community was segregated and separated, and although it's really strong in a lot of different areas, it's really strong in pockets. And so how do we, as a recovery, you know, community come together and really provide a really a face and voice that recovery is possible? And being able to kind of come together and not just be, you know, a recovery dance with three people, on the dance floor and everybody against the wall. You know, we aren't a glum lot, right? And so I wanted to make it possible to really come together as a community and break down those barriers and not just, enjoy life in recovery, but celebrate life in recovery, you know, alongside ourselves and out loud as well. Friends of mine and I started Recovery ATX. Then it was Recovery Alliance of Austin. We met at Austin Java every Sunday for a couple of months and started putting this thing together. I can tell you that life in recovery these past 11 years has been amazing. I can't imagine myself doing anything else. And I can't imagine what I would be doing if I was using. Because I know I wasn't really living when I was using. I was just trying to exist. And there was a lot of things that that perpetuated, you know, that using. That negative self-talk, the feelings of helplessness and hopelessness and worthless. And that shit isn't there today. And so I know that recovery happens when we do the work, and then also too when we're able to carry it forward or pay it forward, and give that shot of hope, and anything is possible. So I am at 8:20, right on time. Thanks. Yeah.